Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View here on BBSRadio.com Station 2. I'm your host, PK, and I'm here every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern. And at this point, I would like to pay homage to the suits in the office and thank the BBS Radio for always promoting First Amendment rights, free speech, free press, and the great Western tradition of free inquiry. On this show, I speak about a lot of different topics, especially free market economics of the Austrian School of Economics, history, geography, some philosophy, political science, politics. Global politics. What is that? I'm trying to think of the word for that. Global. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the word. But and I'm totally into the whole free speech thing. And I like to cut to the chase on my ideas or solutions on how to fix things. And what I especially like about this network is that I am not under any corporate Zionist control. So I speak my mind, and I'm very critical of Israel and Zionism. And at this point, I would like to say to all the government pricks that are listening, like from the CIA, FBI, NSA, and all these other Americans who like to screw and oppress the rest of us, screw you. They don't like this kind of show. They don't like what I have to say, because I'm very critical of the CIA also. And, of course, the CIA manipulates the truth, manipulates the news media. Its tentacles are heavily involved in so many things, including with their buddies in the FBI, apparently, enabling terrorists. I much prefer the old-fashioned type of terrorist. You know, the ones that made their own bombs and sometimes blew themselves up accidentally because they didn't know how to put them together right. Not the kind that are constantly enabled and set up by the FBI and or CIA so they can blow up more stuff and scare us more to justify their jobs. You know, give me the old-fashioned terrorists, all right? The ones that just did shit on their own. And, I mean, I don't want any terrorism, but I'm making a distinction between the kind that are constantly enabled by the FBI and the CIA and their other, you know, these other government organizations, be it Britain's MI6, which probably had a lot to do with the Tubes bombing in July 7th, 2005. And, of course, Israel's Mossad, which I think was heavily – I think their fingerprints are heavily all over 9/11. So with that brave, bombastic, shameless introduction there – I welcome anybody out there, my multitudes of listeners. You can call in here and speak with the mighty PK, which is me. And the number is 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. Actually, the word I was looking for is geopolitics. I speak a lot about geopolitics, and I watch the presidential debates tonight, so I could observe the massive differences between the two candidates. Not. So it doesn't really matter, folks, because, you know, come November, regardless of who wins, the New World Order globalist Illuminati will have their new puppet. They'll have their new globalist puppet, and they'll have the same unchanging foreign policy and probably the further bankrupting of the country. You know, I can't stand either one of the candidates. I didn't vote in 2008 because I couldn't, the first time ever, I couldn't stand the Libertarian Party candidate, Bob Barr. What a despicable bastard he is, and I couldn't believe he was even nominated. So, of course, I didn't vote for him. As a libertarian, I couldn't stand John McCain. Still can't stand it. War Hawk idiot. In fact, I think McCain should go back to Vietnam and finish his sentence. And I, of course, I couldn't stand Obama. I knew everything about Obama would happen, the big spending, the crushing the civil liberties, and I knew the country would be fed up with him, or half the country soon after. And of course, that happened. Anybody can make predictions, but it doesn't take a genius to make that one. So, but this year, I like the Libertarian candidate. I met him on July 4th, and that's Gary Johnson, former two-term Republican governor of New Mexico, who vetoed probably more spending than any other governor or president, and who wants to end the drug war, wants to re-legalize marijuana, does not want to attack Iran, wants to bring the troops home, and, you know, face up to the fact that the entitlement programs are bankrupting the country, and that it cannot be sustained. And so he's got, you know, more of a realistic take on things. He's on the ballot in at least 48 states. He likes Ron Paul, but, you know, Ron Paul didn't make it through, unfortunately. I wish I could have been his advisor, because he should have been more combative in certain ways and used some key phrases and left out some words like I told him once. I told him a couple times, and I even wrote it down for him. I met him last year at the Republican debate, one of the Republican debates. I gave him the day after he was still around. So I gave him, I had typed up something to give to him, and I said, I pleaded with him, you know, Dr. Paul, please don't use the words we or America did. Say the federal government. When you say the federal government each time, you are clearly delineating where the blame lies. So I always say the federal government or Uncle Sam. I have correctly conditioned myself not to say we, not to say America did, because America doesn't usually do this stuff. It's the actions of the federal government doing a lot of things that Americans don't even know is going on overseas, and then we're expected to fight the battles that the federal government has created in the first place. So, you know, that is something that I like to alert people to. I have a guest that I hope will be coming on very shortly. He is a friend of mine. He's been on here before, young college student. And we're going to talk about a few things. His name is Angad. He's been on before. He has a Indian background. If you were to say dot or feather, it would be dot. And don't forget, I have my shameless humor often permeates a lot of what I have to say. And I think our friend is out there. My friend Angad, are you out there?
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. Namaste.
Namaste to you.
Buenas tardes, amigo.
I get that more here, right?
I bet you get spoken to in Spanish a lot.
Yeah, absolutely, all the time. It's a common thing.
Well, here. You do look very Latin. I have a friend who's Persian, and I always say to him, what part of South America are you from? But he's not. But, you know, he has the darker skin, and he has that look. So if you live in parts of the country where there's Latin, you know, a lot of Latin folks or Spanish is spoken, even if you're not of a Latin extraction, you will be spoken to in Latin because you have the look. I get it a little bit, too.
Yeah, I've also got Italian and Sicilian before, so
really?
You know, they just can't figure out which nationality I am.
You got that lucky, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
What nationality you are? Aren't you an American, boy?
Far from it.
You're American now. Where were you born?
I actually grew up in the West Indies in Barbados, and you know, also lived a little bit in India, you know, where my folks had grown up. So just kind of got a little bit of, you know, the best of both worlds there.
Barbados, the jewel of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
So now, you being of an Indian background, and before you came on, I said, you know, if someone were to say dot or feather, I would say dot, but, you know, you don't wear the dot. So
right.
There's my American naivety speaking right there, humorously, of course. So you must be a smart cookie then. Because Indian immigrants who come to this country are usually very successful and well-educated. Or are there exceptions?
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely Indians come out here and work very hard, you know, almost how it was in the 50s with, you know, the Irish and Italians, you know, just really working hard to, you know, make an honest living out here.
Well, that would be even further back than the 1950s for that crowd. But, well, that's good. So, and as I understand it, when Indians emigrate, they are quite successful, yet India remains quite poor. Although it does have quite a large middle class now, I believe the size of India's middle class would equal the size of America's population.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we had a conversation about this before, you know, just for the fact that they're moving towards more of a democracy. You know, a lot of businesses from the U.S., you know, and all over the world are venturing into India. You know, you go to Bangalore and, you know, there's a lot of U.S. Companies out there. So, yeah, certainly, I mean, you know, with the middle class right now, I mean, you're finding a lot of people, you know, driven with, you know, capitalism. So they're understanding the benefits of capitalism.
But you mentioned that India is moving towards democracy. Well, I always thought India was billed as the world's largest democracy.
Right, right.
So I sort of caught you in a contradiction there, a bit of. But you mean, what you mean is India is becoming hopefully more capitalistic and more open to trade and innovation and technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's definitely a player in the future, as it is right now, one of the BRIC countries, that being Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely those countries are, you know, coming up for sure. You know, the only thing that they should guard against is, you know, what the U.S. has been making a mistake with, you know, always inflating the dollar. And, you know, hopefully they don't go down that route.
Definitely. Now, you are taking, when I spoke to you about coming on tonight, you said you were studying your finance homework.
Right, that's correct.
Is this the first finance class you've had?
Yeah, actually it is. You know, just kind of touching the surface of the class right now. So, you know, just, you know, kind of a guinea pig right now with the class.
This could be dangerous to you or for you because you have a slight and growing background in the Austrian School of Economics.
Right.
So when your finance class, which I assume it will, or if you take other ones that are perhaps more advanced, they'll probably talk about the Fed or Federal Reserve policy, and most students just take it as a matter of fact. Oh, we need the Fed. This is how it works. No one has really scratched the surface of it until Ron Paul came along and really put them on the defensive. So I'm curious, up to now, as far as you've gotten in your new finance class, is the Federal Reserve mentioned?
So far, there hasn't really been too much of a mention of it. So you know, that's kind of good. We're not really getting into those details.
Have interest rates been mentioned?
We've got a little bit of interest rates, but, you know, we're just kind of touching the surface right now with the class. So, you know, I guess we'll kind of see where it progresses, you know, within the next couple of months here. But, you know, certainly those things haven't come up as much so, which is, I guess, you know, a good thing.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying when it comes, just, you know, be prepared to know that the Fed is the architect of inflation. It's the creator of the booms and busts, with, as you know, the bust cycle. So I would find it difficult to take a finance class and know that they're, you know, later on in different finance classes, unless they mention it here, but knowing how evil the Fed is and what it does, I would just find that hard to, you know, take that class and be exposed to that fraudulent aspect of it. But, I mean, finance is good to know otherwise. You know, what else? Are you still taking accounting?
Actually, I've finished up with the accounting, but don't have any plans to do too much in that. That class was definitely, you know, too much of a nail-biter. So
was it really?
Glad that I finished with it. Yeah.
Pretty difficult? A lot of math?
Yeah, quite a bit, but, you know, there's just, you know, a lot of, you know, the stuff that they used in there that, you know, just didn't add up, so, funny enough, add up, but, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, definitely not one of my favorite classes, you know, actually switched to a, more of a management major with the MBA, and, you know, looking to take as many, you know, classes in that regard.
Well, that's good. Did you take accounting or bookkeeping in high school?
It kind of touched on it, but not as much in high school. But I think now in a lot of the school systems, they are kind of implementing it in high school too now.
Well, I took accounting 1 and 2 in high school, and I had 2 accounting classes in college. And I recommend everybody learn some accounting because it helps you do your paperwork, your bookwork. It helps you run your life, organize your expenses, So I didn't do all that great in it, but I know some of the principles, and it helps me manage other things as far as organizing it on paper, too, and how to organize it somewhat. Nothing near as advanced as, regular accountants, but it's a good thing for people to know. So I always think that most students should take some business classes.
Yeah, absolutely. At that time, they were offering the accounting courses, but, I think it was more of an optional basis, but, I hadn't taken the class at that time. I guess, having some of those courses that you said are, helpful down the line, especially if you want to start your own business or, start your own gig, but, certainly at that time, I hadn't thought about, the benefits of taking such a class.
Now, if you went, I know your undergraduate degree, I think, was in, telecommunications or something like that?
I'm actually more geared towards communication and media studies.
Right. And so when you look back at 2020 hindsight, would you have still majored in that, or would you think you would have majored in business and had a master's by now, or would you have done would you have done things differently?
Well, I think, I'm kind of gearing up, in a good way here that I have a little bit of both. You need good communication skills and you need to understand what's out there, with a communication degree in the same regard. Having a business degree is definitely helpful. It definitely helps out. But I know you and I had gone back and forth about, what I should have done in grad school, but I know you were kind of joking around about going to law school, and a sales gig.
Don't do that. Well, yeah. I wish I would have studied harder. That's one of my faults, but I made up for it by being insecure about it and being more self-taught. Mm-hmm. And now I am a brilliant intellectual on my own radio show.
Yeah, absolutely.
With all humility, of course. But I wasn't trying to bust your balls about it. I was just saying, when you look back, would you have been better off, say, majoring in business with a minor in telecom? Would that have been a better way to go?
Yeah, I think maybe that would have been a good option, too, just to start off with business. There's a lot of opportunities, as long as you're kind of eliminating the Keynesian stuff that you're taught in school. I think, you can benefit from having a business degree right from the get-go. So, yeah, that's definitely, something that I look back at. Maybe I could have done that and minored in communications. That would have worked out, too.
Sure. So you're in your late 20s now, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Becoming an old man now.
How does for your generation and even the younger folks, are the job prospects still pretty damn bleak?
It just seems that it is that way. Here in Texas especially, there are a lot of opportunities versus some of the other states in the Northeast or, the East Coast for that matter, but certainly it is difficult. You're just kind of fighting just to get to the top, where maybe, say 10 or 15 years ago, that may not have been as much of a problem. That's just something that has been kind of an ongoing issue with, the last few guys in office here.
Well, Texas has a pretty good reputation for job creation and a fairly strong economy as states go.
Yeah, there is stuff here too, but it just depends what industry that you do like. The oil and gas industry is pretty big here. The energy sector is really good, but it all just depends on what you really want to do. It just kind of varies across the board.
Well, that's true. However, your generation and even the younger students or post students, college students, what they want to do and what is available are going to be two different things quite often, especially nowadays in this economy. So where do you see yourself? Do you see yourself interviewing for a firm once you graduate? Because you're going to graduate next year with your MBA, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you see yourself, do you see yourself working for another company? Or if the economy gets worse, do you see yourself just trying to get a decent job, period?
Yeah, I think that definitely defeats, the whole purpose of, going out there and, doing an MBA. But, I think the biggest thing that, I'm recognizing that, at this point in time, if those opportunities aren't presenting itself, why not create those opportunities for myself and maybe, venture into something with my own business or, in that regard, certainly you have that ability to branch off and, set something up on your own behalf too. But, again, it just kind of varies, from situation to situation. But I do think that, just kind of looking forward here with just a couple more semesters left that, maybe it would be good for me to just look into, my own business and, starting up something on my own.
So in other words, you're going to be a drug dealer.
No, not quite.
Well, I'm not ragging on you or your plans at all. I'm just seeing, I don't see the economy getting better. I don't see Romney as the savior. And I think of your generation, I'm thinking, man, just because now, like for college kids or post-college kids, getting a nice waiter job is a good thing. Or bartender.
Yeah.
It is, because I see a lot of college kids doing with that. So keep doing what you're doing. Get your education. I won't say finish your education because it's never finished unless you think that way. Like, oh, I'm done with college. I don't read anymore. I don't need it, blah, blah, blah. But to keep it prepared for you. But I still think, that's a great thing you're doing for your future. But I still think that for your generation, because of this economy and these idiots in Congress, you're still going to have a really tough time for the next few years as far as employment opening up further. I don't really see it. I worry about it. I know you had spoken to you had mentioned before, or maybe this plan can change too, as plans do, is that you at one time even considered possibly relocating to India.
Yeah, I mean,
once you
go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, once you maybe finish your MBA, which I would understand. However, as I understand, India is very competitive too. So is it six of one, half a dozen of the others? I mean, what do you think?
It just kind of varies, on each situation here. Going overseas, whether it's even India or maybe another market, there's certainly a lot more opportunities right now, countries that are growing. And you've brought up, about the BRIC countries, that are up and coming. So certainly if there are opportunities presenting itself overseas, that's something that you definitely have to consider. That seems to be kind of, what we're running into with the program with my MBA. A lot of people are just kind of pursuing something more on the domestic front for an MBA versus a globalized MBA. Because a lot of people just, they're frightened to, get outside the country and, pursue other opportunities in other places like, in Europe or Asia or, wherever else.
Well, that's good that you've traveled. You've been out of the country. If one, like, I know you have an Indian background, but you weren't born there. What's it like, not that people are dying to move to India, but, I mean, is immigration difficult in India? I mean, if you wanted to try to get a job there, what's immigration like there? Do you know?
It just goes across the table here, but, I think, with a lot of U.S. Companies coming out there and having a U.S. presence and, having a lot of companies come through, that's certainly kind of opening up opportunities for, a lot of people to come out there and work. Actually, I was talking to a guy in one of my group studies that I had for one of my management classes, and he was mentioning to me that, last year he had just actually gone on a business venture out there, and, they were looking for some people to, stay out there for a longer, basis.
That could be something good, interviewing with some U.S. companies that do a lot of business or have things located in India to get hooked up with one of them. How's your Hindi? How well is your Hindi?
It's all right. I mean, certainly not on par with the rest of my family, but, I can get by, with a conversation here and there. So, I guess if I'm back in that environment, I'd pick it up within a couple of months here. But, certainly I think it wouldn't be too much of an adjustment.
Do the people of India have their own, I don't recall, their own writing? their own alphabet?
I'm not 100% sure how that is, honestly. I know it's kind of, pathetic being Indian that I don't know that, but, I'm not 100%
sure. Is it Sanskrit?
I can tell you.
Well, okay, so people in India that speak Hindi, you know, do the masses of people in India, they speak Hindi, but what are the signs written in? Are they written in English? What is the Indian alphabet? I mean, is there...
Again, I mean, honestly...
Doesn't Hindi have an alphabet, its own alphabet?
I couldn't honestly, tell you. I mean, I wish, I knew those details in that regard, but,
When you go there, when you've been there, I mean, what are the street signs? What are the street signs written in?
I guess, in Sanskrit, in that regard, but again, I'm not 100%.
So Sanskrit... Sanskrit is like an alphabet, right?
Right.
Okay. So you've been to India a couple times. I've still not been. I would like to go, but if I go, I would love to go to Nepal. I would love to see if I could get into Tibet.
Right.
I mean, because if I go, I want to, make it quite the deal. There's another small country over there tucked away near Nepal and India called Bhutan.
Okay.
Bhutan, I believe. Have you heard of it?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
And it's an older civilization, and people don't hear much about it, but that's sort of an interesting part of the world,
Right.
And I guess I would think that you're lucky having been there a couple times. Did you always enjoy your visits there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to do out there. Every time you go, there's, India's just kind of across the board, different in those terms, for traveling purposes. Not like how you're just here in North America where, everything's pretty much the same. You have to go through smaller pockets to really, see what America really is. But
true.
In terms of India, there's definitely, a lot out there, to do, whether it's, hiking or trekking or, just a little bit of everything for everybody. So I think that's definitely the benefit. Depending on where you are, it kind of changes with, like if you're in the south, it's more kind of coastal and, very beachy. But, the further up north you go, more mountainous and, definitely a lot of, fun activities as well.
So the first time you went,
mm-hmm.
were you kind of overwhelmed when you first landed and got there? Was it overwhelming?
I think the first time I went, I was probably about 8 or 9 years old, and at that point in time, maybe I wasn't as overwhelmed. At that point in time,
it's a different thing. Okay, well, yeah. How old were you when you went the second time?
I guess a little bit of a difference at that point in time. Been living in the U.S. for a little bit, and then you go over there naturally. There is a little bit of adaptation once you go over there, but.
But is it initially like overwhelming the second time? Is it like culture shock?
I think it can be for a lot of Americans or a lot of foreigners when they first come in, and certainly
there's so many people.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Because all of a sudden there's so many people. It's thickly populated. I would think that you see that right away.
Yeah, I think that can be a little bit intimidating. Just coming into Bombay for the first time, or as it's known now, Mumbai, it can be a little bit of an adjustment. There's a lot of different things, whether, you're used to, driving in air-conditioned cars, first time you're coming out, maybe you're, sweating immediately and, basically going in a taxi and, having a bunch of people just walking right beside you. So that can be a little bit of an adjustment just for purposes of, having your own space and having your own comforts. But, I think the thing that I realize is that, you feel a lot more free-spirited once you leave from there. So every time you leave, you feel like you want to stay a little bit longer.
Well, I heard that India takes you in,
Yeah, absolutely.
Once you go. What is the... Where do they get their oil from? You know, from their neighbors? Indonesia?
Yeah, I think, you know, they kind of work closely, you know, with the neighboring countries, maybe with the Middle East as well, too. But, you know, again, that's not something that I'm very familiar with. But, yeah, I think, you know, if I would have to, you know, put a finger on it.
I was curious. I don't even know if they have any domestic oil production in India itself.
Right. You know, again, I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, again, I think I'm with you on that. I think they go probably to the Middle East and, you know, kind of venture out there and, you know, work with, you know, the folks in the Middle East.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a, you know, it's a fascinating country with a long history. And most of the middle class folks there, you know, would you say that maybe half the country speaks English or some English?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely easy for, you know, foreigners to come in, you know, even though Hindi and it's kind of one of the main languages out there. You know, I think it is easy for people to come into a place like Bombay or, you know, somewhere in Bangalore or New Delhi, for that matter. It shouldn't be too bad for them to find somebody, you know, on the streets that, you know, speaks English. So it's not too much of a adjustment in that regard. But just kind of depending on where you are. And, I mean, if you are in a smaller pocket, then of course, you know, communication would be a little bit more difficult, but, you know, if you're in a major metropolitan place like, you know, like Bombay or like Bangalore, for that matter, you know, it's a lot easier for somebody to go through and adjust.
Yeah, but you have a communications degree, so it ought to be easy for you.
Yeah.
Thank you. So, well, I'm glad you've got to go there a few times and check it out, and it must be pretty fascinating. And
yeah,
a lot to see, a lot of history, interesting architecture, you know. So, like, I understand the culture and everything, so, you know, I'm good with all that. It's just, I just find it very interesting. And I think that one extra plus that India has is the fact that English is the second language there,
mm-hmm.
which means that that's a little jump that they have on China. Because I've told some of my friends, their kids or grandkids, man, if they were to start learning Chinese nowadays and stayed with it in their early children youth, you know, it probably would come handy, because I believe that this is China's century, and, you know, wealth is shifting, things are shifting. The U.S. will still be a, you know, major power, but, you know, the U.S. empire is collapsing, the wars are failures in Iraq and Afghanistan, China's coming up. They got a lot of poverty still, and they got a lot of problems. They have a lot of pollution problems, but, you know, it's a phase they got to pass through. I, you know, despise a communist government, but yet there's a lot of capitalistic things going on over there.
Right.
You know? So
yeah.
What is your I went to see Atlas Shrugged Part 2. Have you seen Part 1?
You know what? I actually just, you know, touched the surface with Atlas Shrugged. They actually had it on Netflix, so, you know, just trying to, you know, finish up the movie, but been really busy here the last few weeks, but, you know, certainly that's kind of on the to-do list here to, you know, finish it up.
So you haven't got to see the first one yet?
I just touched the surface on the first one, so just kind of touching the surface there, but, you know, hopefully I'll get to go through it here, you know, when I get a little bit of a breather coming up.
Did you ever read that book back in the day?
I think, you know, I think actually you had given family quite a few books on that, so I think...
I know your sister did. I don't know if you ever did.
Yeah, no, actually, I think more sister and, you know, the folks have been a little bit more well-versed in that regard. Something,
well, I liked Part 2.
I'm getting into. Okay.
I liked Part 2, and some of the actors were using exact Ayn Rand quotes from her, you know, what is the root of money, some of her things, which was very cool, which I liked right away. And I like the second one. There's got to be at least one more, I would think. So, and it's not playing everywhere, but I enjoyed it. What I didn't, I like this Hank Reardon. I like these, the two, what do you call it, the heroines of the movie, Hank and Dagny. However, they were not the same actor and actress as in the first film. I preferred the actor and the actress in the first film who played Hank and Dagny, but in the second film, I still like them, especially Hank, and I liked his voice. Have you seen the previews for it?
Yeah, actually, I haven't seen the previews yet, but I know the folks were recently talking about it, so definitely something that I need to check out. I know the whole family had gone to see the first one, you know, in theaters, but, you know, with having so much on my plate, working full-time and studying full-time, I didn't get that opportunity, which I really wanted to do.
It opened last Friday.
Yeah.
It opened last Friday. Are you still working now, or are you still work? You have a part-time job, or are you still working?
You know, I'm still kind of serving with, you know, an advisor role for this company, with the IT company that I'm with. But really, I guess, you know, the main priority right now is just trying to figure out what, you know, has to go on here after, you know, graduation. So
are you still working part-time, or you said advising to the company that the boss you didn't care for?
Yeah, I mean, just pretty much, you know, serving as...
So you're still on the periphery a bit, still making some money.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, that's good. That's good. Yeah, so where do you see this election going? What do you think? Who is it leaning towards?
Quite frankly, you know, as long as... If it's not Ron Paul, I don't really care. You know, it's just the same thing, and this is just a big gimmick and, you know, a big thing between the two of them. So, really, it's just kind of a cat and mouse, and, you know, they're both in on it.
Do you know about Gary Johnson?
Yeah, actually, I've been learning a little bit through Dr. Paul, actually, you know, watching a few things on him. You know, he seems like, you know, he'd be kind of a good fit for the Libertarian Party going forward, too.
I met him on July 4th. And I gave him that little pamphlet, Why Austrian Economics Matters, and he thanked me for it. And he's going to be my my choice, because obviously Dr. Paul didn't get in there, and Gary Johnson wants to end the wars, bring the troops home. He doesn't want to attack Iran. He wants to re-legalize marijuana. He wants to end the stupid drug war. He wants to balance the budget, you know, and reform the entitlements a bit. So, you know, he's the only choice out there. He'll be on the ballot in 48 states. Republicans have acted against him, trying to keep him off. You know, so it's just awful what they do to third-party candidates. And then people say, well, there's only two choices. It's like the law of gravity. You know, only two are going to win. Well, the law of gravity doesn't have artificial government barriers and restrictions and stupid laws or rules keeping it from functioning as it normally would.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. He definitely seems like, you know, a good guy to represent the Libertarian Party.
Yeah, of course, Libertarian Party. What about the whole country? Wouldn't he be a good president for the American people?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, again, what more do you want with, you know, than somebody who's patriot and that really actually does care about the country? You know, the only people that I've really seen that have shown that have been Dr. Paul and Gary Johnson, as you mentioned.
Yeah. So, do you have full citizenship yet? Are you still working on that?
Yeah, we're still working on it. You know, hopefully within the next few months we'll have that, you know, tied down. But of course, you know, quite a bit of activities going on for the family and stuff. So
yeah,
well, you know, got our hands full.
When you get these jobs that you work at, do you have a V1 visa, or what do they call it? You have a green card?
Yeah, a green card.
Okay, so you're good then. Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
So, what other classes? I know you're taking finance. What else are you studying?
You know, right now I'm just in a couple of management classes and a marketing class as well. Marketing classes quite a bit so far, you know, that we're going through. You know, just a lot of work, a lot of projects. So,
is it difficult?
Quite a bit on shelves. I think it just kind of varies for each professor that you have. You know, the material might be difficult, but if you do have a good professor, then that doesn't, you know, matter as much so. But, yeah, right now it's pretty difficult, quite a bit, you know, to go through, and definitely quite a lot.
Have these profs, a lot of these business profs, have they run businesses or, you know, been businessmen in the real world?
I think it's just kind of a combination. You have people that have just gone for their PhDs and are just, you know, straight out teaching, you know, maybe more so in finance or accounting, because those are more, you know, based on mathematics and stuff. But, you know, there are some folks that, you know, work for different companies and stuff, but just kind of varies for each situation. You know, right now, I think most of the people that I have this semester haven't worked as much so in, you know, the business world, but more so just gotten their PhDs and are teaching right now.
Yeah, so they haven't had a real hands-on job per se. They may have not ever really had to run a business per se or meet a payroll, yet they're teaching business.
Right, absolutely.
Which is not necessarily a bad thing, but there's nothing like having a prof who's been out in the real business world and then he's teaching in your class. Kind of like being a doctor teaching, you know, surgery, a surgeon teaching surgery, you know, like hands-on. That's what he does full-time. And now he's bringing that, you know, to his students because he has absolute experience on it.
And I think that was the one good thing about the communication program, that you had a lot of professors that, you know, had hands-on experience working for different media outlets or, you know, even just working for different papers or publications. So that certainly did help out, you know, for that itself. But, I mean, again, for the business program, it's just kind of all over the board. You just have, you know, a lot of people that have just done their PhDs and are just teaching on that level. And as you said, may not really have, you know, as much experience out there work-wise, but at least in the, you know, business field. But, you know, whatever works for them, I guess.
Well, PhD is also referred to as piled higher and deeper. You ever heard that one?
No, I haven't actually, but, you know, that's a good one I can use too.
You haven't heard that one?
No, I haven't.
Piled higher and deeper.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know, it's good for you to get a master's, and I think you should still, you know, stay on that course. And again, if you understand business, you can do a lot. You know, it enables you to do a lot of different things, and it's a good thing to know because it gives you an overview of you know, the business world, and you've had finance, accounting, and marketing, so those are good things to have, and you know, hopefully you'll find employment somewhere decent. What is your short-term goal? You think you're going to interview at different companies, you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just see what comes up. Obviously, you know, again, there's a lot of stuff in oil and gas, but, you know, just on the short-term basis, yeah, maybe look into something like that. But, you know, been really considering about just branching off and doing something on my own. Where that goes, I don't know at this point in time, but, you know, certainly I've been thinking that that might be a better route for me to do.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, I appreciate you coming on to talk to the mighty PK.
Sure, thanks for having me, as always.
Yes, and I hope you'll still have a little time to keep one eye on the Austrian School of Economics. I know you went to that seminar in Houston last January, I think. And if they have another one coming up, I'll let you know about it. But that was a good thing to do. So I'll let you get back to the real world and your studying. And what are you also go to classes, or is a lot of what you do online?
I'm actually doing as much as possible face-to-face. You know, so I try to incorporate, you know, face-to-face classes, you know, as much as I can. You know, it's, again, more hands-on, so try to incorporate that as much as possible.
Well, that's good. That's good. All righty then. Well, Angad, I thank you again for coming on to Third Stream View. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I'm glad, you know, school's going well for you, and even though the job situation is bleak, they can't take an education away from you, so, you know, good luck getting that MBA.
Yeah, absolutely, and, you know, thanks again for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure to be on the show, and, you know, definitely keep doing, you know, what you got to do.
Do you ever feel like you've spoken to a godlike person when you speak with PK?
I guess you could say that, right?
Thank you very much. I did say that. Thank you. And yeah. I hope you don't miss my humility too much.
Yeah, absolutely, but, you know, it's always good to be on the show and, you know, always keep people informed. So, you know, always want to keep the people informed and, you know, let them know that we care about, you know, their rights.
That's right. So I'm going to thank you now. I'm going to say goodbye now. Thanks again for coming on God, and good night, sir.
Yep, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I, PK, am still here talking to my young friend who is the future of the country, and hopefully he will have a brighter future around the bend, but I, you know, I am very pessimistic about the immediate future, and I think it's getting worse. I saw, as I said earlier, the two candidates were on tonight, and it's just funny to hear them go around and around. They're basically the same. They're basically the same, and they both said, you know, nothing's been taken off the table, which means, you know, a violent attack on Iran. And if they do that, they will unleash nuclear fallout. You know, it's just awful, and I hope they don't do it. Romney would be much more likely to get us into a war, especially with Iran. I mean, Romney is owned lock, stock, and bagel by the Israeli lobby and, of course, the military-industrial complex. He just comes off as like such a stuffed shirt. You know, he's just, I don't know, insincere. I think of him as an oily, stuffed shirt, used car salesman. No disrespect to used car salesmen, but, you know, it's obvious that, you know, Romney's handlers, you know, they wanted it to be less of a warmonger tonight, and it would seem like Obama's handlers wanted him to be more of a warmonger, so they seemed to meet in the middle a bit. But, you know, that was just a lying smokescreen. And, you know, it's such a scam of a bipartisan foreign policy. It still dominates. You know, it's a bipartisan foreign policy. It doesn't change. It matters who's in office, you know. And both parties are just, you know, two twins. They're twins of empire, what we call interventionism, big spending, and war. And, of course, Israel, Israel, Israel. It's always mentioned. You know, this is an American debate about America. And, you know, Israel is our greatest ally. They keep talking about Israel. They're not our 51st state, you know. And I have no fear to say that, of course, the media in Hollywood is strongly under Jewish Zionist control. I believe that the major networks, the media networks, are under a Zionist Jewish control, the Rothschild-backed Zionists. And I stand with the Jews united against Zionism. They are on the right path. Their numbers may be small, but their philosophy is righteous. And they will tell you that their God and the Torah, the Old Testament, never intended for the Jews to have their own country because they disobeyed God. And they can't have their own country till the Messiah comes. Well, consequently, you got all these Christian Zionists who are also concerned about Israel. A lot of them want to bring on the, you know, World War III or IV even sooner, so Jesus will come back sooner. I mean, that's like their mentality, and they're cheered on by idiots like Pastor John Hagee, and in Texas, and of course, what's his name, Pat Robertson. You know, I don't even know if these people realize that, you know, the majority of the world Jewish population is overwhelmingly purely secular and or agnostic and or atheistic. And that is, they practice their religion as a tradition. So, you know, on this show, I like to talk about anti-Zionism and Israel. I'm anti-Israel, for that matter, and Jewish power. And I don't say it. Mine is always a expose on power. I'm not saying it as a criticism followed by kill these people or this group of people should lose their human rights or their, you know, constitutional rights. I'm not into that at all. But I like to be very critical of where I think it deserves to be said. And you won't hear this on the major networks because they're afraid to say what I said. But there are some prominent anti-Zionist Jews who would be in agreement with me. Gilad Atzmon, A-T-Z-M-O-N, who wrote The Wandering Jew. He is a former Israeli, and actually a former Israeli soldier now, but he's quite the jazz musician living in England, and outspoken critic of Zionism in Israel. So I'm a fan of his. I'm a fan of Rabbi David Weiss, from one of the lead spokesmen from Jews United Against Zionism. I like Normal Finkelstein, who wrote the Holocaust Industry. So, you know, this is a very strong power structure. And in studying this for about the last 10 years about, you know, Jewish history, Israel, my studies have brought me to the conclusion, much to the probably consternation or criticism of some, that, and I don't say this hatefully, I just think it's, I happen to think it's true. I've come to the conclusion that this same bunch of bankers, you know, people criticize the banks and the bankers, well, the Federal Reserve and member banks, the Federal Reserve, that's very Zionist, you know, Jewish Zionists in control of that banking system, and then international banking, the Rothschilds, and their Masonic, you know, I guess Gentile Rockefeller, you know, axis, the Rothschild Rockefeller axiom, if you will. So back to what I was saying, I'll be damned or I'll be darned if this same banking crowd now, this international banking crowd, largely Zionist at the top, I'll be darned if this same international banking crowd is not the enduring legacy of the same international bankers that Hitler railed against over 80 years ago. I'm not afraid to say that, and I'm not saying anybody should be harmed. I'm just saying in studying Hitler and why he said and did some of the things he did, I'm starting to see where he was coming from on this. I'm not condoning any of the genocide, but I'm seeing where the criticisms come from. And when he always spoke about Jewish Bolshevism, well, he knew, as did, I guess, much of Europe, that, and I've mentioned this on the show before, that, and this is before World War II, almost 10 years before, that Stalin's commissars and his overseers of the gulags, and also the main players in the revolution, you know, probably 75-80% of them were Russian Jews. So Hitler railed against Jewish Bolshevism. Well, Jews were the architects of it. And in Russia, Russian Jews oversaw the murder of over 20 million Christians in, you know, I'd say between 1932 and 35 or 6. You know, Stalin had the purges. So that's what I see, a legacy of that. The international bankers and the Rothschilds play a big role in international banking. You know, even from behind the scenes, they're still massively in power. And, of course, you've got the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission and the UN. You know, all these bastards, they want world government. You know, they don't talk about it. They're totally in denial about it. But that's what they're into, the Bilderbergers. You know, well, if that's what they want, why don't they tell the people that? Clearly, state your aims, you know, but it's hidden behind layers and layers of bureaucracy and different organizations and lies and half lies. And, you know, so that's how I see it coming about. So we basically will have the same foreign policy regardless of Romney or Obama. I call it Obama-Romney 2012. That's how I see the election. Obama-Romney, 2012. They both support the wars, or widening the wars, pathetic Patriot Act, the despicable Military Detentions Act, Gitmo, the drug war, you know, more of the same. I just can't stand Romney. He's such a stuffed shirt, stuffed suit, you know. And, you know, anybody can run a business if he's got billions of tax dollars at his disposal, or millions of tax dollars at his disposal, like Romney used for the Winter Olympics that he was behind. Oh, big deal, you know. And also his Romney care required billions of federal dollars to fund that mess. So you know, I don't see things getting better. And Rami doesn't understand economics. He doesn't know world history or world geography very well. And, you know, he's real tight with Netanyahu. They go way back. So, you know, Israeli lobby, his tentacles are very powerful. AIPAC, very powerful. So I'm sure he will genuflect before them. You know, that's how I see it. I don't trust either of those bastards. And, you know, global Zionism and the globalists and the New World Order, they will march on regardless of, you know, who's in power. Their puppet will still rule us, be it a Republicrat or a Demopub. And so don't expect anything fancy from either one of them. They both represent, again, Romney and Obama both represent the big banks or serve the big banks, Wall Street, especially the military industrial complex, and the all-powerful Israeli lobby. So that's how I see it, because that's how it is. I believe that's how it is, but I wouldn't get be able to say this on national news or the, you know, the major networks. They don't want to hear that. And of course, they're all under Jewish control anyway, or Zionist control. So very pro-Israel. So, you know, what I have to say, you know, they think I'm a kook. Well, they're the kooks because they're expanding the wars and running us into more debt. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to take my brilliance and wisdom and retire for the evening. And I would like to say thank you for joining me here at Third Stream View, your humble host, PK. I'm here every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern. Thanks again for my friend Angad for coming on, talking about employment, geopolitics, this and that, Romney, Obama, O'Romney. So that is it, ladies and gentlemen, until next week. Thank you, the millions of you, for tuning in. And with that, your humble host, PK, here, is saying good night.